You are listening to Changing the Story series on Development in the Pacific Islands podcast. This is episode 1, Development Overview with Professor Vijay Naidu. Let's get started.
Bulavanaka everybody, this is Teresa Fox. Welcome to the CTS series podcast. Changing the Story podcast is produced every fortnight for your enjoyment and information. Our show notes can be found at the Institute for Mission and Research website. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. All links are in the show notes. Now let's get into the show. Professor Naidu, tell us a bit about your interest in doing this and sharing your knowledge with the Pacific Islanders concerning development, what you've seen over the years, and what you think needs to change.
Well, you know, we are talking about development that has taken place this far, and there are some positives, but also a lot of negatives. And with the COVID-19 pandemic, we are now in a situation to reflect on whether we want to carry on as business as usual or we want to change. Changing means to address those negative aspects of development that have affected human communities as well as the natural environment. My talk this morning will address those dimensions. Well, you see, in the region today, what we have are some of things that are very similar to what has happened elsewhere as a part of the development process. So what we have is, Pacific societies have urbanized. Pacific societies have developed manufacturing and some industries where they have the resources and capacity to do so. But also tourism has become important. In some places, forestry is significant, as is mining, as well as fisheries. So what has happened is that this has triggered a movement away from rural areas into urban settlements and areas of commercial activities. And accompanying that are a number of issues. And this includes issues relating to the nutrition that people have, the shelter that people have, the quality of life they have, what incomes they have and how they spend it, what kind of nutritious or non-nutritious food they have, and the kind of diseases that they suffer from, as well as their life chances, whether or not they are able to have access to opportunities and to services, and whether they have the good life. And what you find is that the situation in the Pacific reflects in many ways the situation in other global South or third world countries. So you have a small minority in the elite who are doing well and who have good incomes, good standards of living, generally well-educated, and who have living standards that are equivalent to first world countries. And then you have the majority of the population who actually are struggling. And then right in the bottom of the pile, you actually have people who are below the basic needs poverty line. In other words, they don't have adequate nutrition, they don't have adequate shelter, they don't have access to education, health, and other services. So that's our situation, and a situation that really needs attention.
The promise of development and the development models that mostly imported promised good living for almost everyone. Why has it turned out that the stats?
Yeah.
more negative than positive.
So now if you look at when these countries got independence, Samoa in the early 60s, Fiji, Papua New Guinea in the 70s, and some of the others in the 80s, that was indeed that promise that now we will do things for everyone and everyone should benefit. But what has happened is that the economic development policies that we have followed are policies that are based on private enterprise. And private enterprise is about producing commodities for sale in the market for profit. And of course, some of the corporations are not just simply profiting, but that here for profiteering. And so they take the lion's share of the resources. In order to get infrastructure going, like roads, bridges, you know, jetties, airports, etc., as well as your public utilities, water supply, electricity, governments have also borrowed money domestically as well as from abroad. So the debt profiles of Pacific Island countries have also increased. We don't really have that amount of funds to ensure this kind of upward, you know, movement in people's living standards. There has been some improvement, but not sufficient. But also, it has to do with the policies of government. Unfortunately, in recent years, governments have followed World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and Asian Development Bank initiatives and policies. And in a general sense, these organizations are a front for the American Treasury. The American and British models of development are the worst forms of development because they lead to gross inequality and some of the worst social indicators. And one of the indicators is mental illness, as well as the number of people in prisons. So the model is been called the neoliberal model, where governments are told to reduce their size, cut down on regulatory frameworks relating to the environment, relating to labor, relating to social development, education, health, shelter, and social protection, which are generally directed for the benefit of the broad masses of people, and concentrate in narrow economic activities, increase your GDP, and, you know, then pay your debts, etc., etc. And so you may have economic growth, but you don't have development. Development as in the sense of improving the general standards of living and well-being, human security and human rights of people. There has been some improvement, as in there are more people who are educated, the levels of literacy have increased, more people have access to health services, people do live longer, although in some places like Fiji has been static for decades now. Maternal mortality and infant and child mortality figures have declined, except for places like Papua New Guinea and Kiribati, Solomons and Vanuatu. Infrastructure has improved, you know, better roads, and you see that the emerging middle class in many Pacific societies. So those are the sort of signs of development and progress. But on the downside, you also have some big issues, beginning with, you know, like issues of nutrition. People eat a lot of junk food. There's an Americanization, a McDonaldization of Pacific societies. If you go to the waterfront, you find empty Coca-Cola bottles, empty cans, you know, of Coke and fizzy drinks and all that. These are not good for us, but this is the strength of marketing. And our people think eating and drinking those types of thing is the way to go, when in fact our traditional foods and you know, diets are much better. But you also look at social inequality. What you find in the Pacific as a whole, social inequality in the Pacific is actually worse than in Southeast Asian countries. Years ago, decades ago, Southeast Asian countries realized that they couldn't rely on the families alone because their social fabric, their cultures were also being changed. So you didn't expect the elders, the disabled, the unemployed to be all looked after by the family. In the Pacific, that mentality continues to exist. And so the formal social security system in the Pacific is really seriously lacking. So families, extended families are supposed to look after their vulnerable. And they are not succeeding because families are also changing from extended families and, you know, sub-clans. They are going to nuclear families. And they are more and more dependent on money rather than growing their own food. And so all these have impacts that are negative. And of course, as you have this urbanization underway and people are not necessarily being trained for the different areas of demand in the labor market, there's a lot of unemployment. And so young people generally are more likely to be unemployed and underemployed. And so once you are unemployed, underemployed, then you tend also to get into trouble with authorities. And so if you look at the statistics on prison population, the largest proportion, 60 to 80, even 90%, are people in the age group of 18 to 30. And so this is not very good.
Even though, yes, we've made progress, it seems like we've sacrificed a lot, too, of the good things that we had in order to achieve the progress that was promised.
Yes. Well, you know, I don't want to romanticize about pre-contact, pre-European Pacific Island societies, but in those societies, if you like, development was holistic. It dealt with people's livelihoods in terms of working together. It is based on social solidarity, on social capital. And then the proceeds of labor, you know, your agricultural produce, the fish, whatever you hunted in the forests, these were then brought together and people consumed together and shared these things, you know. And in those days, people gained status by giving, not by taking, not by accumulating. So the big men, the chiefs, were centers of redistribution, gathering and then sharing. So while their social status would have been higher and there was social status inequality, everybody had access to land, to sea, and other natural resources so they could make a living. That's not the case these days. Because people lived in nature and with nature, they realized how powerful natural forces were. And this compelled them to be extremely spiritual. They were sacred sites, their gods, their chief god was very powerful, and they spent a lot of time worshipping and placating and making sacrifices, including the presentation of fresh food, through the chief, the bete, and so on. So their life cycle, their work cycle, was permeated with spirituality. What has happened with proselytization and Christianization, there was initially a real big belittlement of Pacific religions. Pacific arts and cultures were being pushed aside. Very belatedly, there was a realization that, hey, these people also prayed, they also worshiped. They had this kind of spirituality, this oneness with nature. And let's stop destroying the artifacts, sacred sites, etc. That's accepted by the mainstream churches now. Although the people who do this prosperity preaching, the new evangelicals, they continue to be destructive and rubbish everything in the past. And that's completely wrong. Wrong because that's the heritage of Pacific Island people. That's a heritage that gives them dignity and pride. So if you keep pointing out that their ancestors, this, that, and the other, without positively appreciating those aspects that led to social solidarity, sense of community, respect for nature, oneness in nature, then you get into this destructive mode that we find that has happened. So what we have done, foreign distance water fishing nations have mined our oceans, so we can't catch fish to feed ourselves. Forests have been destroyed because people went for the, big timber and they just simply bulldoze everything. And so now you have floods where floods never used to happen before.
Your people being displaced from where they live.
Absolutely. And, mining has done the same thing. And Papua New Guinea and Nauru, which have some of the worst mining history and environmental damage, these are the first countries that want seabed mining. You couldn't manage terrestrial mining. The deep oceans that you don't know much about, you're going to get mined there. Now, this is not on, So the greed for material things and individualism as against social solidarity have all impacted negatively on Pacific societies and cultures. The sharing, the giving has been replaced by increasingly individualistic, self-centered and nuclear family-centered orientation.
So what would you recommend in terms of development?
If you look around the world, there is one global capitalist system. In this global capitalist system, the developed countries of the world take the lion's share of the resources, energy resources, global income, and they are wealthy. And then you have countries of the global south that are relatively poor. But within the countries that are rich, you find great variations. And therein lies some models for us to look at and say, hey, these people are looking after their citizens better, they're looking after their environments better, and they have a real nice quality of life for the majority of their, great majority of their population compared to other countries. So let me just quickly go through these countries. So the best models of development you'll find is in places like Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Iceland. These are Scandinavian countries where the government plays a very big role in development, emphasizing the social, good housing, good food, good education, free education, all the way to university level education is free, Social protection, universal social protection. Germany also does similar thing, works with a labor union to ensure that in times of economic crisis, the workers are not just simply booted out of their jobs, that actually they are supported, they are protected and retrained for employment in other sectors that are growing. So Germany is a good example. Places like Japan have developed capitalistically, but they have not lost their language, haven't lost their culture, they have respect for their old religions, the elderly, and they have a stronger sense of community. Even China has opened up, and many transnational corporations have gone to China because Chinese labor used to be cheap. But the Chinese opened up to grow the economy to alleviate poverty. So millions and millions of Chinese have been lifted out of poverty. So economic growth is there to provision society, to improve the living conditions for everybody. So if you look at the Scandinavian model as against the very bad American and British models, then you say, hey, we don't want to be like USA, which is now being ripped apart by, these protests over the killing of black people because of the systemic racism. You don't want to be like that. And you don't want to be like the UK even. And both these countries have had very bad control over the COVID pandemic compared to many parts of Europe, Japan, and the East Asian countries. So for me, there are like four broad actors in development. These actors are government or the state, then communities, civil society, and the private sector. And if they all played their roles in a kind of balanced way, I think you'll be able to have good development. Yeah, and development needs to be participatory. So it's always going back to the people and getting their views about any projects, be it environmentally related or social, employment. So you get this constant feedback, and that helps you manage development so that it is benefiting all citizens. And for me, that's critical. What has happened in the last 30 years, thanks to the multilateral financial institutions, we have followed the American Treasury's influence, which is deregulate, privatize, corporatize, reduce tax, and user pay. And all that, you know, one size fits all, has been detrimental to the Pacific, you know, and it's affected people. If you look at figures in the Pacific and Micronesia, here in Fiji and Samoa, suicide rates have increased for young people. Mental illnesses have also, you know, multiplied. And the NCDS is a huge pandemic. Yeah.
So you know? What do you think, because we're countries that are largely dependent on aid and support from donors, do you think we can do this? We can come up with
absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. The thing is for government leaders to have some spine and not jump up to everybody who offers you some money. You know? They need to have a good sense of what they want for their people. Their people are the ones who voted them in, not foreign donors, not foreign NGOs, and certainly not the multilaterals, you know. You listen to them, you listen to your own people, and then you make a decision about the best ways of doing this thing. And you look at what impacts the policies adopted by countries following this donor country or, you know, multilateral advice, you know, have led them to, you see. And if you go along that way, then I think you are better served. You see, in the case of Fiji, when Fiji was subject to the sanctions from Australia, New Zealand, the US, the Commonwealth, and even the Forum, Fiji began to do things on its own. It opened other avenues of diplomacy. Fiji never was heavily dependent on aid compared to, say, Kiribati, Tuvalu, Solomons and Vanuatu. And Fiji could say to foreign donor countries, you stick it, we don't want your aid. But you see, after we had the elections, everyone is running here to Fiji. And of course, for the Pacific now, we are back into, if you like, the 70s and 80s, when there was this Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. And so countries could say, you know, okay, if you don't give this to us, we will go to some communist bloc country to get assistance. And then the so-called allied and free world countries would come in, say, no, we'll do it, we'll do it. Well, now with the Chinese, the same geopolitics is being replayed. The extent of leverage that Pacific Island countries do have now is certainly much greater than in the 1990s when they were forced to restructure, reform according to the structural adjustment programs that were pushed forward by the multilaterals.
Now, with COVID-19 and the big wake-up call, there is an urgent need to re-envision development in the Pacific Islands?
Yes. Well, you know, in the case of Arundhati Roy, she said this COVID-19 and the big stop, the big pause that has occurred, this is a case of doing an MRI, a scan on societies and say where we are at. And it might actually open a new vista, a new vision of where you want to go. And as the concept note says, whether we want more gender violence, whether we want more environmental destruction, whether we want more social inequality, and all that means for society and for people. And the answer is to be a resounding no. You know, a resounding no. And what has happened is that the private sector has suddenly gone very quiet into his own shell. Because, you know, you remember that old saying, government's inefficient, leave it to the private sector. The private sector will contribute to economic growth. Well, that's a whole lot of hogwash and rubbish, as shown by COVID-19. So government, the state, has a big part to play in development.
And the Pacific people, what can we do?
Well, they have to tell their governments, wake up and do the things we want. So we want better provisions for health, you know, so we don't get caught with our pants down. Better provisions for health. We want better education. We want free education at the highest level, better quality, which involves putting resources into education in a big way, which is part of social protection, training our youth so that they can get jobs or be self-employed with skills, you know. We want everybody to have a certain level of income so that they're not having to eat substandard food, be malnourished, you know. And so the state has a role in all of this, you know, reflecting the community's interest. And the community is made up of diverse interests. It includes farmers, it includes workers, small business people, big business people, people who are part of religious groups, people who are reflecting particular ethnicities, etc., etc. So these different groups should be encouraged to organize, to be empowered, and they should then be able to articulate their interests and what they want to government. And it's government's job to look at what it is they want, set priorities, but always with the notion that we are doing good of all the people and not particularly, you know, specially treated elites, business, wealthy people, but for everybody. And that's a big ask, because the system is benefiting a few at the expense of the majority. So you remember that movement? 1% is getting everything and 99% hardly anything. So don't forget the 99%. In the Pacific, it's the 20%, 10 and 5% who are actually minting it, and the majority are not. And that has to change.
So if the story of development does not change, and we don't use this opportunity to re-envision things, what do you see in the future?
Well, it'll be business as usual, you know, and people who form the majority of society will continue to struggle, continue to suffer, and, you know, be malnourished, be infected with diseases.
So you see the statistics worsening?
Yes, yes, as it has been over the last few decades. You know, we have got these multilaterals that keep manipulating figures, and the figures were corrected only because China has alleviated its poverty in a big way, maybe Vietnam. But in other places, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, the situation is as dire as it was in the 70s and the 80s, you know. The situation has not improved. If you look at India with the shutting down, you know, by the Modi government, millions and millions and millions of day workers were forced to go on foot to their villages, sometimes hundreds if not thousands of kilometers away. Children, women died, and men died from exhaustion and lack of food and water along the way. And these are the same day laborers, casual workers, who form the bulk of the informal sector in the Pacific. They are the most vulnerable. The one-third that form the formal workforce are, you know, somewhat better off, and some much better off, and they're a whole lot slightly better off, but certainly better off than a majority of the people in the informal sector, you know, do semi-subsistence agriculture, or who are working as casuals in industries, in sunshine workers, or newspaper pickers, bottle sellers, backyard garages, etc., etc., you know. And so if you want to improve their lot, then you have to change your policies. And my view is that we have gone down the wrong road. You need to tax people according to how much they can afford. So the rich should pay more in taxes, and the rich and the poor less. Everybody gets taxed through the sales tax, the value-added tax, and government should make sure that the tax then is used to redistribute through social development programs and through social protection. Yeah, one other point that I did not mention that goes together with the informal sector is informal housing. Just about in all Pacific countries where the population is growing, see, unlike the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, you have informal settlements. Substandard housing have been mushrooming in Papua New Guinea, in Fiji, in Solomons, even in Kiribati. And this substandard housing is due to insecure tenure and people being poor, and basically government having failed to provide social housing. And so they build their own with whatever they can find. And of course, it's substandard. And in those kinds of situations, disease and infection spread, you know. Crowdedness makes it possible. And many places don't have proper water supply, electricity, etc. So a caring government would actually have social development programs that have policies directed at informal settlements, upgrading, rehabilitation, resettlement, new housing. And we just have not had enough of that. And unfortunately, that is also reflected in many countries of the third world. So we need to change in a drastic way. Attend to development holistically that deals with material circumstances, always as well as spiritual, mental well-being, which comes out of social solidarity. We have to build that. And we have to ensure that livelihoods and returns to labor are fair so that people can have decent living and actually enjoy the human rights as they are supposed to.
Parting words for Pacific Islanders that are listening?
Well, I think it's important that everybody, no matter what their standing is in terms of income, wealth, and social status, they should be interested in what happens to the most vulnerable. Because when you look around the world and we see countries where the vulnerable, the poor, the disabled, the weak are treated in an unjust fashion, we have a negative image of that country. We don't want the Pacific to be like that. We want to be seen as a caring people. A caring people are people who believe in the community and in social solidarity. And that goes together with the finest teaching of all religions, you know? And that's what we should be attending to, individually and as social groups.
A big vinakavakalevu to Professor Vijay Naidu for that enlightening overview of development in the Pacific. We've had decades of development, made progress on many fronts, but if more than half of our people are still suffering, it is time to change the story of development. It is time to re-envision development that takes care of everyone's well-being. Thank you for listening to this episode of Changing the Story. You can find our show notes on the Institute for Mission and Research website, www.imr.ptc.ac.fj. Please share the podcast and help change the story.